nobleman shouted back. "Today," Abner demanded. "When I finish with the sandalwood," Kelolo promised. "Kelolo, it is not sensible to lead your men back into the forests right away." The big man scratched his back on a coral head and growled, "You've got to get sandalwood when you can find it. It is wrong to demand so much of your men." "They're my men," the chief insisted. "They'll go where I tell them to go." "It is wrong, Kelolo, to hoard sandalwood when the taro patches and the fish ponds remain unattended." "The taro will take care of itself," Kelolo said grimly, diving deep to be rid of the irritating voice. "Where will he come up?" Abner asked. "Over there," Keoki replied, and the missionary ran along the sand, holding on to his tall hat, so that when the chief surfaced, there was Abner staring at him. "Kelolo, God says we must respect all who work." "They're my men," the huge nobleman growled. "And that platform," Abner continued, "it's not been taken down." "Don't touch the platform," Kelolo warned. But the missionary was disgusted with the chief's behavior and ran awkwardly across the sand to the offending platform of old gods and reached down to throw aside the rocks of which it was composed. "No," warned Keoki, but Abner would not listen and began tossing the ancient stones into the sea. One rolled near Kelolo, and when he saw his own handiwork thus destroyed, he uttered a wild cry, leaped from the surf, and dashed inland, grabbing the lame little missionary by his clawhammer coat and throwing him violently to one side. "Don't touch the rocks," he roared. Abner, stunned by the suddenness of the attack, rose unsteadily to his feet and studied the naked giant who guarded the platform. Recovering his hat, he placed it firmly on his head and moved resolutely toward the collection of rocks. "Kelolo," he said solemnly, "this is an evil place. You will not let me build a church, but you hold on to your evil old gods. This is wrong." And with his right index finger extended as far as it would reach, he pointed directly at the chief. "It is Heva." The naked warrior, hero of battles, was inspired to pick up this worrisome little man and crush him. But the solemnity of Abner's manner stopped him, and the two stood there under the ko'u trees, staring at each other. And finally, Kelolo temporized. "Makuahale, I promised you land for a church, but I must wait until my king sends word from Honolulu." "Shall we tear down this evil place?" Abner asked quietly. "No, Makuahale," Kelolo said firmly. "This is my church in the old fashion. I will help you build your church in the new fashion." Quietly, Abner said, "When I stand beside these rocks, Kelolo, I can hear the voices of all the victims who were sacrificed here. It is an evil memory." "It was not that kind of temple, Makuahale," Kelolo said forcefully. "This was a temple of love and protection. I cannot surrender it." Abner had the sense to bow to this decision, but he did so in a way that Kelolo never forgot. Lifting one of the stones reverently, the little missionary looked at it and said, "If you consider this a rock from a temple of mercy, I can understand why you wish to preserve it. But I shall build a church that will truly be a temple of mercy, and you will see the difference. To your temple, Kelolo, only the strong Ali'i could come. In my temple, it will be the weak and the poor who will find mercy. And when you see the mercy that spreads out from my temple, Kelolo, believe me, you will come to this shore and throw every rock in this pile far out to sea." And Abner strode to the shore in as impressive a manner as his limp would allow. And at the edge of the sea, he drew back his arm and pitched the solitary rock far into the waves. Then, holding his hat, he came back to Kelolo and said, "We will build my church." The tall chieftain kept his promise. Wrapping his tapa about him, He marched through the hot sunlight to a fine piece of land north of the mission grounds, where he paced off a generous area and said, "You can build your church here." "This is not enough land," Abner protested.
"Enough for one god," Kelolo replied.
"Your own temples have more land," Abner argued.
"But they also have more gods," Kelolo explained.
"My god is bigger than all the gods in Hawaii."
"How much land does he require?"
"He wants a church of this size," Abner insisted, and Kelolo was astonished. But when the marking out was completed, he said,
"Good. I will call the kahunas to determine how the church should be arranged."
Abner did not understand Keoki's translation and asked, "What's he going to do?"
"Call the kahunas," Keoki explained.
"What for?" Abner asked in astonishment.
"The kahunas have to decide where the door should be, where the people will sit," Keoki explained.
Kelolo, sensing Abner's repugnance, hurried to explain, "You must not build a church without permission from the kahunas." Abner felt dizzy. Frequently, since his arrival on Maui, he had been confronted by positive confusion. Malama and Kelolo both eagerly wanted Christianity for their island, and each had given substantial signs of surrendering a good deal to the new religion. But repeatedly, they indicated that they considered it not a new religion, not a truth that would shatter old ways and introduce salvation, but merely a better religion than the one they had. Once Kelolo had reasoned, "If Jesus Christ can give you big ships with many sails, and Kani gives us only canoes, Jesus Christ must be much better. He is welcome." Malama, impressed always with the power of the written word, had corrected her husband,
"It is not ships that Jesus Christ brings. It is the manna there in the black box," she said, indicating the Bible.
"When we learn to read what is in the box, we will know the secret of manna, and we too will be strong." "Jesus does not bring either ships or books," Abner had patiently explained. "He brings light that illuminates the soul."
"We'll take the light too," Kelolo had agreed, for he was tired of his smoky oil nut candles when the white man's whale oil lamps were so obviously superior.
"I do not mean that kind of light," Abner had started to say. But sometimes the Hawaiians were too much for him. Now, however, he was adamant. "No kahuna, no evil heathenish priest is going to say how we shall build the Church of God."
"But kahunas," Kelolo began.
"No," Abner shouted. "The door will be here. The steeple will be here." And he placed big stones at the critical orientations. When he was finished, Kelolo studied the intended building for a long time. He looked to the hills and beyond them to the mountains. He studied the pathway of the little stream and the distance to the sea. But mostly he studied the rise and fall of the land as if it consisted of human hands waiting to receive the building, which would soon rest within the palms. Finally, he shook his head sadly and said, "The kahunas won't like it."
"The kahunas will never enter it," Abner said stiffly.
"You'll keep out the kahunas?" Kelolo gasped.
"Of course. This is a church for those who obey Jehovah and keep his commandments."
"But the kahunas are eager to join," Kelolo protested. "They all want to find what power it is your God has that enables his people to build boats and make new lights that are better than ours."
"Oh, you'll have no better people in your church than the kahunas."
Again, the dizziness, the crazy irrationality of Hawaii attacked Abner, and he explained slowly,
"I have come with the Bible to wipe out the kahunas, their gods and their evil ways."
"But the kahunas love Jesus Christ," Kelolo cried. "He is so powerful. I love Jesus Christ."
"But you are not a kahuna," Abner countered.
Slowly,
Kilolo raised himself to his full, austere height. Makuahale, I am the Kahuna Nui. My father was the Kahuna Nui, and his father, all the way back to Bora Bora.
Abner was stunned by this intelligence, but he felt that the moment was critical and that he must not surrender his position.
I don't care if your great-grandfather Bora Bora was a kahuna.
Bora Bora is an island, Kilolo said proudly.
I never heard of it.
Now Kilolo was astonished.
In Boston, they did not teach you about...
He stopped, thought a moment, and then placed his right foot on the stone indicating the door to Abner's church.
Makuahale, we are in the time when gods are changing. These are always difficult times.
When I argue as a kahuna, I am not defending the old gods of Hawaii. They have already been defeated by your god. We all know that. But I am speaking as the kahuna who knows this land. I have often spoken with the spirits of Lahaina, and I understand the hills. Makuahale, believe me when I tell you that this door is wrong for this land.
We will build the door here, Abner said resolutely.
Sadly, Kilolo studied the obstinate man who understood so little about churches, but he argued no more.
Now I will lead my men back to the sandalwood trees.
When we have returned three times, I will direct them to build your church.
Three times? Kilolo, the crops will be ruined by then.
They are my men, the huge chief said stubbornly. And that evening, he led 2,000 of them back into the hills.
On the 30th day after the arrival of the missionaries at Lahaina, Malama, the Ali'i Nui, had her handmaidens clothe her in the new China silk dress that Jerusha Hale had sewed for her. She put on shoes for the first time, heavy sailor's shoes with the laces untied, and covered her wealth of long black hair with a wide-brimmed straw hat from Ceylon. Then she ordered her servants to lay new tapa with extra care, and when this was done, she lay prone on the floor, directed the fanning to begin, and spread before her a sheet of white paper, an inkpot, and a china quill.
Now I shall write, she announced. And in a clean, disciplined hand, she composed this letter in Hawaiian for her nephew in Honolulu.
Liholiho King, my husband Kilolo is working hard. He is going to buy a ship. Aloha, Malama.
When this exacting task was completed, the huge woman heaved a sigh and pushed the letter toward Jerusha and Abner.
Then women came in to lomi-lomi her, and she smiled proudly from the floor as Jerusha said,
I have never known a person to learn as fast as Malama.
When Keoki translated this, his mother stopped smiling and brushed away the lomi-lomi women, saying,
Before long I shall write to the King of America in your language, and I shall use all 26 letters.
She'll do it, Jerusha said proudly.
Now, little daughter, Malama said, you have taught me well. You must go home and rest. It is Makuahale who shall teach me now.
Dismissing Jerusha, she rolled over on her belly again, propped her chin in her hands, stared at him intensely, and commanded,
Tell me about your God.
Abner had long anticipated this holy moment, and he had constructed a patient, step-by-step explanation of his religion. And as he began to speak with Keoki's help, he sensed that the huge woman on the floor was passionately eager to know all that he knew, so he worked with special care, choosing each word exactly, and consulting often with Keoki as to its translation into Hawaiian, for he knew that if he could win Malama to the side of God, he would automatically win all of Maui.
God is a spirit, he said carefully.
Can I ever see him?
No, Malama. She pondered this for some moments and said, "Well, I could never see Kane either." Then she added suspiciously, "But Kalolo has often seen his goddess, Pele of the Volcanoes." Abner had sworn to himself that he would not be led down bypaths. He was not here to argue against Kalolo's miserable assortment of superstitions. He was here to expound the true faith, and he knew from experience that once he started on Kalolo's gods, he was apt to get tangled up in irrelevant arguments. "God is a spirit, Malama," he repeated, "but he created everything." "Did he create heaven?" Abner had never confronted this problem, but he replied unhesitatingly, "Yes." "Where is heaven?" Abner was going to say that it is in the mind of God, but he took the easier course and replied, "Up there." "Are you certain in your heart, Makuahale, that your God is more powerful than Kane?" "I cannot compare the two, Malama, and I cannot explain God to you if you insist upon comparing them. And don't call him my God. He is absolute." This made sense to Malama, for she had witnessed the white man's superior power and knew instinctively that his God must also be superior, and she was gratified to hear Abner proclaim the fact. On this principle, she was ready to accept his teaching completely. "God is all-powerful," she said quietly. "Then why did he bring the sailor's pox to infect our girls? Why does he make so many Hawaiians die these days?" "Sin is permitted by God, even though he is all-powerful, for it is sin that tests men and proves them in God's eyes." He paused, and Malama indicated to one of her many servants that they must keep the flies off the missionary, too, and soft feathers swept his neck and forehead. Although he appreciated the attention, he felt that Malama's instructions had been an interruption consciously commanded by the woman to provide time for her thinking. So he added gravely, looking directly at the chieftain, "If you continue in sin, you cannot know God." Pausing dramatically and bringing his face close to hers, he said with great force, preparing the way for the great decision that would later become inevitable, "Malama, to prove that you know God, you must put away sin." "Is it possible that the Ali'i Nui herself is sinful?" Malama asked. For her religion took care of this problem by postulating that the acts of the Ali'i were the acts of gods. But she was to discover that in Abner Hale's new religion the answer was strikingly different. Pointing his forefinger at the prone woman, he said firmly, "All men on earth are totally depraved. We abide in sin. Our natures are permeated and corrupted in all parts of our being." He paused, then fell to his knees so that he would be closer to the Ali'i Nui, and added, "And because kings have greater power, their sin is greater. The Ali'i Nui is the most powerful woman in Maui. Therefore, her sin is greater. Malama," he cried in the woeful, desperate voice of John Calvin, "we are all lost in sin." A child cried in one of the surrounding huts, and Malama asked, "Is that baby filled with sin, too?" "From the moment that child was born." "No, Malama, from the moment it was conceived, it was steeped in sin. It was drowned in mortal vice, horrible, perpetual, inescapable. That child is totally corrupt." Malama pondered this and asked tentatively, "But if your God is all-powerful..." Then she stopped, for she was willing to accept Abner's earlier answer. She thought aloud, "God has arranged sin to test us." Abner smiled for the first time. "Yes, you understand. But what will happen, Makuahale, to that baby if it is not rescued from sin?" "It will be plunged into fire everlasting." "What will happen to me, Makuahale, if I am not saved from sin?" You will be plunged into fire everlasting. There was a pause in the grass house as Malama shifted her weight on the tapas. Rolling over on her right side, she leaned her jawbone on her right hand and motioned Abner to sit on the tapa near her. "What is the fire like?" she asked quietly. "It leaps about your feet. It tears at your eyeballs. It fills your nose. It burns incessantly, but you are constantly recreated so that it can burn you again. Its pain is horrible beyond imagining. It's..." Malama interrupted, asking weakly, "Once I traveled with Kamehameha to the edge of a burning lava flow, and I stood with him when he sacrificed his hair to appease Pele. Are the fires worse than that?" "Malama, they are much worse." "And all the good Hawaiians who died before you came here, Makuahale, are they living in that perpetual fire?" "They died in sin, Malama. They now live in that fire." The huge woman gasped, took away her right elbow, and allowed her head to fall onto the tapa. After a moment, she asked, "My good uncle, Keawe Mauhili, is he in the fire?" "Yes, Malama, he is."
"Forever?"
"Forever."
"And my husband, Kamehameha?"
"He is in the fire forever."
"And that baby, if it dies tonight?"
"It will live in the fire forever."
"And my husband, Kelolo, who swears he will never accept your religion?"
"He will live in the fire forever."
"And I will never see him again?"
"Never." The remorselessness of this doctrine overcame Malama, and for the first time she sensed the truly awful power of the new god, and why those who followed him were victorious in war and could invent cannon that swept away tribal villages. She fell to sobbing, "Awe, awe," and thought of her good uncle and her great king wasting in fires eternal. And her servants brought cool cloths to ease her, but she brushed them away and continued weeping and beating her huge breasts. Finally she asked, "Can those of us who are still alive be saved?" This was the question that had once given Abner most trouble. Can all be saved? And it stunned him to hear it coming so precisely from the mouth of a heathen, for it was the touchstone of his religion, and he replied, "No, Malama, there are many whom God has predestined for eternal hellfire."
"You mean they are condemned even before they are born?"
"Yes."
"And there is no hope for them?"
"They are predestined to live in evil and die into hellfire."
"Oh, oh," Malama wept. "Do you mean that that little baby..."
"Perhaps."
"Even me, the Ali'inui?"
"Perhaps." This awful concept struck Malama with great force. It seemed a lottery of life and death, a god throwing smoothed pebbles into a rock hole, and sometimes missing. But it was the god who missed, and not the pebble. For unless the god had wanted to, he need not have missed. With pebbles, he was all-powerful. Then Abner was speaking. "I must confess, Malama, that all who slide into evil do so by the divine will of God, and that some men are destined from birth to certain fire, that his name may be glorified in heaven.